You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, coming at you from that terrible place known as Gotham City. The flood has pretty much destroyed everything. I haven't seen Batman in days, and I don't know what we're going to do, but I'm just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and I'm so glad he's here with me, the one, the only Riddler. I mean, John Mills.
Hey, I'm neither Vengeance, I'm not the Knight, I'm just an average guy trying to make his way through Gotham City. Sure, I didn't know when I moved here I'd need hip waders, but things happen, and you just got to make the best of it.
Well, I mean, weren't you originally from Florida where, you know, massive hurricanes can happen at any moment? Shouldn't you already have waders?
You would think so. However, what we usually do is we put on shorts and then dance in the rain to heavy metal music. So, because excellent. The thing is, it's the rain sort of moves through when you're in the central part of the state. So,
Well, here comes the sun, because we're going to be talking about the Penguin. We're really excited to be doing this. But before we do that, quick reminder, find us wherever you get your podcasts and make sure you're subscribed. And that way you will get the podcast episodes as soon as they drop here on the 602 Club. You can also find us all over social media. We're on X Twitter at the 602 Club. We're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can also find us on Facebook with the entire network at Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can also find the website at trek.fm. And then we've got a listeners only discussion group that you can find called the Babel Conference and talk to listeners from all over the world, as well as going over to Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM and becoming part of the team and just making sure that we can keep all of this great material coming to you. But John, first, I just wanted to ask you, I think we both did enjoy the Batman.
Yes.
And we thought it was a good interpretation of the character, even coming off something that we did really like, which was Affleck's Batman. This being kind of a very different take on the character. It's not Batman Begins. It's not, you know, Affleck's older Batman. It's someone who's just learning the trade, but has been Batman for a bit. And so I wanted to ask you, just even coming into this, though, when you heard that they were going to be doing a series based around the Penguin, how are you feeling about it? Was this something that you were excited about, or was this something that you had any interest in, or is this just something you're like, oh, this will fill the time before they finally ever give us Batman 2 in 2026?
Yeah, well, I was interested immediately, because I think anybody would be lying if they said that Colin Farrell was not a scene stealer in the Batman. Everybody talked about him playing the Penguin. He inhabited that role so completely that I earned a new respect for Colin Farrell while I was watching that movie. I was like, my goodness, he is amazing. Because it was just this side of like a De Niro parody without being a parody. Like, he just fully inhabited the character. And so I think he was, you know, he was terrific. And they're like, oh, we're going to have a show about him. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And then I saw the trailer and I was like, okay. Now, I'll couch all that by saying, having had my heart broken a couple of times by some other franchises out there with their streaming shows, that I always go into these things with a little bit of trepidation. But as soon as I started hearing people react to it, because I wasn't able to see the first show on the day that it debuted, when I heard everybody basically saying, oh, wow, this is actually really good. Like, immediately I was like, okay, I'm committing to this show. I'm going to ride it all the way out to the end. What about you? Were you excited from the beginning, or was it more of a tempered expectation?
No, I think you actually just nailed it on the head, in the sense that this was a character from this film, the Batman, which became something that I think you rightly just said, he was a scene stealer. He was somebody that you couldn't keep your eyes off of when he was on screen. And the whole time, I think you were just kind of thinking to yourself, that's Colin Farrell?
Yeah.
Where? Because you just couldn't see him. You legit could not see the character there. And in the sense of, you know, so many times we're watching these shows or movies and, you know, the actor playing the character completely shines through. I mean, a case in point, right? Clooney as Batman. It's just George Clooney the whole time. It's never Batman.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is just somebody who completely gets lost in the makeup, really goes method with this thing, and you just don't recognize. I mean, this is like, maybe this is an anathema, but I'm saying this is like Daniel Day-Lewis style type of performance where the guy just becomes this person and you don't recognize them as Colin Farrell whatsoever.
He's definitely helped by the makeup with that, because there are exactly. times where like his eyes twinkle through and stuff like that. But I think that's a fair comparison. I mean, people will be freaking out being like, oh, he's no Daniel Day-Lewis. Okay, look, Daniel Day-Lewis is unquestionably a once-in-a-generation type of talent when it comes to mimicry. But Colin Farrell's never been a slouch. He's always been a good actor. He's always been a really good actor. But I completely agree with you that it is a Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, he's unlocked a new level, and it is the Day-Lewis level of I can't see him anymore. Like I and part of the fun of watching the Penguin on screen, both in the movie and in the show, and I would stop doing it because I'd get so caught up in the show and the character, but is sitting there trying to find him is half of the fun. And the fact that you can't find him, like you look for him, you're like, all right, this is where I'm going to get him. And then you go through the whole scene and you're like, ah, no, he's still in there. And then you sort of like relax about it. That's kind of the fun of watching him in this role.
I couldn't agree with you more on that, which, you know, in all honesty, I really do think this is something that we just have to start on with this show. We've already started talking about the title character and the performance there. And, you know, I think that Colin Farrell and his portrayal, what it does is it adds a depth to the character, which has you going along with this character, even though by the very end of the show, he's just so utterly despicable as a person. Like, the transformation of being a guy you were kind of rooting for to the end of the show where it's like, oh yeah, I'm ready for Batman to take this dude down. I like him. I want him taken out.
Mm-hmm.
That is an incredible performance of a character.
This show in those terms and this performance, this arc, and you got to give credit to the writing and the direction and the everything that goes together.
Yes, you do.
But the performance is always key to it as well. Is this is just like watching Vic Mackey in The Shield or Walter White in Breaking Bad, because there's a charm. And this is a very specific acting skill. There's a charm and a charisma that an actor can use to keep pulling you back in. And you keep getting pulled back in with this character, to your point. And then the show, two episodes after, it knows it's gotten you to sort of let your guard down. And you're like, yeah, okay, you know what? It's kind of been. And then it just throws it at you. And you're like, oh, no. I mean, This is an absolutely reprehensible human being of a character, and you feel gross for having ever been on his side, because you realize that the arc itself is a mimicry of what the core of the character is, which is the sociopathic manipulation of people.
Yeah.
And you just got jobbed. It's really something else.
You were saying that, and all I was thinking of was The Godfather 3. You know, every time I think I'm out, they keep pulling me back in.
Yep.
And that's exactly what Colin Farrell does for this character.
Yes.
Every time you think you're out with the character, he does something terrible. You're like, but then he does that other thing, and I can't stop, you know, watching, and I don't know why. It's just a great performance in that way.
If I can offer, I think what it is it's a manipulative move that's brilliant because it plays on the fact that we all expect the character to have some sort of realization, some sort of enlightenment.
Yeah. Yeah.
We always watch a main character and we expect them to have a point where they're like, oh, I've been terrible up to this point. Oh, Marley, thank you for visiting me. I'm going to become a good person. Or, oh, I'm, you know, Steve Martin, you know, Neil Page in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, realizing what a short-sighted, you know, jerk he's been this whole time for not seeing what Dell was trying to tell him. And you keep waiting for that to happen. And this show knows exactly how to just string you along to play on that expectation so that when it pulls the rug out from under you yet again, you know, you can't be mad at it for messing with you.
No, I mean, it's really well said there, I think. And I think that there's something that's really great in this sense of the way in which the show for Oz, they don't deny his evilness in his backstory, right? And as you dig further and further into it, there's no denial of how bad it is, right? And so you're left with, I think, a character that is so completely irrehensible that you're kind of done with in the sense of ever really truly rooting for again. But at the same time, this is the tightrope that they walk that I thought was so interesting, which is so many shows want to make you sympathetic to the villain and make you excuse their evil. This show helps you understand this person, but it never, in the end, at least I'm not left with, and so I'm interested for you, are you left sympathetic to this character whatsoever?
No, you put your finger on it right there. Basically, the Penguin is a serial killer. Period.
Yeah.
He was always going to be this way. And it's one of those things where what makes it so complicated and enjoyable to watch is realizing who enabled it along the way and to their own ends. Because if he, that whole layer of if you just make it to the top, this will all have been worth it. And that sort of thing where you realize, like, it's such a complicated hierarchy of everything, of who is using who to what ends. And what I think the really amazing jujitsu on it is that the antagonist winds up becoming the sympathetic character, not the protagonist. Like, they really flip things around because the antagonist is doing stuff that is arguably just as terrible as the Penguin is doing, but you're talking about understanding. The understanding, you look at the antagonist and you're like, I can understand why she's doing these things because look at the way she's been treated. Look at what everything that's happened. She's not the instigator here. She's the product of what's been done to her, as opposed to Oz is always the creating the problem because of his own unbridled desire.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I do think that one of the most interesting things about this character for me as well was his lack of being able to accept reality, you know, because he lives in a universe of his own making. And he may be the clearest example, I think, of the danger of reality creation I think I've seen on screen, because he can't live in a world where he's not loved and worshipped by those around him. The whole point of his being is to become this person. You know, it's the story he tells in the very first episode of the gangster who rides down the street that everybody, at least from what he perceived, loved. That everybody was calling out his name and treating him like a king, and like, that's what he wants. And he can't accept a reality where that's not the case, right? And he can't accept a reality where people that he care about anybody more than him, which of course is referenced by what, you know, he does to, you know, his own brothers. And so I was fascinated with this, because the end, too, of the show, the very end, is the clearest picture of just how nuts this guy is and just how far he'll go to create a world of his own making that he wants to live in and that everybody else is forced to accept.
Yeah, I guess it's narcissistic personality disorder.
To the nth degree.
I think you're saying it right here, where it's he's created a universe in his own mind so centered around himself. I remember there was a joke from a comedian. It's not going to make anybody slap their knee laughing, but it's always stuck with me, where the joke was, there's a difference between self-centered and self-involved. Self-centered is I'm better than other people. Self-involved is mm-hmm. other people. And that's basically yeah. where Oswald is. Other people only exist in order to serve making him feel good and powerful.
Right.
Up to and including how he uses Vic, which, that's one of those final betrayal moments where it's like, I can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never hoped for a show to make the decision to have a cheat and bring somebody back next season than that. And it is all due to the fact that the way Farrell plays it and the way that the young actor who plays Vic plays it, those things are what makes, it's what makes this show so complex, so amazing. I can't imagine that when a award season comes around, that they don't shower this thing with praise and awards and nominations and spotlights and stuff like that. I mean, this is, here we are, we're going on and on, but like, I'll tip my hand here. This is just talking about the performance and the way they construct the character and who he is. This is an example of how you create a franchise property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just make it really good. You sit down and you say, you know what? What do we have to do? What elements do we need to have? Do we need to have X, Y, or Z? No, you just need to have a really well-written, focused show with a clear idea of what its through line and what its point is. And a story that can stand on its own. It doesn't even matter. Like, you don't even have to have seen the Batman for this to work. And you know how I've gone on and all the times I've been on here. What makes a great sequel? I don't need to see the one that came before and I can still enjoy it.
Yep. No, I'm glad that you brought that up, because what is interesting, and there's it's kind of this weird comparison, I think, between the show where you have a character who's trying to make his own reality. And I feel like this show does the same thing, just as you're saying, where it creates a reality which you don't have to enjoy this show as it being in the Batman universe. You don't have to enjoy this show because it's connected to the Batman. You could just watch this show and enjoy this show because it gives you every single thing that you need to enjoy it. And part of that is because it knows exactly what it's mimicking, and which is all of the great mob stories out there. It takes the comic book characters and brings them into a story that just feels like squabbling between narcissistic mob family bosses, and where everybody's then collateral between them. That's the beauty of this show, is that it truly just understands what it is, and it doesn't even, I mean, in general, you could have probably made this just a show about a city that had, suffered a disaster, and mm-hmm. then the rival mob families were vying for, the hierarchy in the city. Who was going to rule the new city? Who was going to set the new tempo? And I think you're absolutely right in that. And so I love that that's the case. And And I think it's one of the things that, you know, I believe that you and I have talked about, you know, so many times when it came to something like, you know, the Clone Wars and what made it successful, is that it found ways to continually kind of reinvent the Star Wars storytelling by tapping into genres to allow it then to tell new types of stories that still felt very Star Warsy. This tells a story that fits very well within the universe of Batman, right? But at the same time, it stands alone as its own genre type of story. And that's really just, I don't know, it's just not something that we see a lot of. You know, it's kind of feels on, not on par with, but close to the whole thought process of why in the world had we never made an animated comic book movie like Into the Spider-Verse before they did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it almost feels like, why aren't we making, you know, shows like this, which, and I think you rightly, you know, call out, there are other properties that have tried to do television shows, and they have been mildly successful to mm-hmm. terrible. And I think part of that is because, one, they don't necessarily feel necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And two, they don't believe in themselves enough for their own concept to feel like we matter just for ourselves. We have to matter in service of this kind of greater whole. And this show does all of those things. But at the same time, it's like, again, if this was just a show about the Penguin in a Batman universe, and I'd never had a Batman movie to go along with it, I think this would still completely work.
I agree. I think that, you know, to your point, let's go ahead and, you know, even though you love it more than I love it sort of thing, or, you know, like more than I like, however you want to say it, this feels like it's more in the Andor sense of a franchise thing. Where this is just a story I'm telling that happens to be in the universe.
Great point.
And, you know, so yes, it ties together because we get our little love mark at the end of the bat symbol going up. So, okay, there we go. And we have our mention of Selina Kyle. Okay, there we go. But it's not the through line that we need to have to justify the entire thing. And I think that I will always question why it always takes this long. All of the creative people that exist in Hollywood, to your point about Into the Spider-Verse, nobody thought to make something like that until they did. And so it just seems like there needs to be a willingness. You know, we have Reeves here. We have, you know, the production team here that has the vision to say, okay, this is what we're doing. This is the point of what we're doing. And, you know, just to bring it back around, it's not the mistake that you're talking about where it says, oh, this is a Batman property. Therefore, we need to at least have a scene with Batman talking to him. Turns out you don't. You don't need that at all. It's okay not to do that.
Let's jump into that real quick. The whole idea of no Batman in the show. And one, do you think that there could have been a place where they could have inserted it and could have worked? Or do you just think that utilizing the time and the space that this show is supposed to take place in, it one, makes sense for there to be no Batman and works better for the only reference truly to be that very last shot?
I think it works fine. I was skeptical. Do I see Batman being in anywhere here? No. Because once Batman shows up, it becomes his show. If you have Batman come in for one scene, you're going to ask why he isn't there for another scene. That's just, I mean, let's be honest. That's just the way that it is. And I think that it was the wiser move not to have him in there. And in terms of anybody that's complaining, because I know there has been some complaint, oh, why wasn't Batman in there? It's Gotham City. I completely accept. I know there was an explanation out there, but I had it in my brain simply as it's a city. He can't be literally everywhere at once. That's even something that Nolan's Batman touches on, where it's like, I can't do everything by myself. I can't do it all on my own, sort of thing. And that's what's wearing him down. And so, yeah, like, oh, look at all of the stuff that happened while Batman was looking the other way. Sure. There might have been something else he was working on, you know, like,
yeah,
that just distracted him. And that's, you know, and that would be completely fitting with the idea that the Penguin takes advantage of the fact that the spotlight's not on him.
Yes.
You know?
No, I think, you know, obviously, like you said, there is an explanation that's out there. You know, Reeves talked about the fact that this show takes place in a really condensed timeline. And that timeline is like the week after the event happened. And so, you know, I think the show did such a great job of portraying that, though,
mm-hmm.
that it came through for me. Like, I never felt to myself really, okay, so why isn't Batman here? You know, it just felt like, well, how could Batman really be here when you think about what he's dealing with in the entire city of Gotham, which is half of it's just been destroyed,
mm-hmm.
and there's so much to do. There's probably so much crime happening. You know, even this, you know, the movie it's based off of, The Batman, talked about this idea, you know, that the shadows were his friends because criminals were thinking he was lurking in every shadow. But, you know, if you're in a city where there's absolute rampant crime in the way that it's got to exist right now in the aftermath of this, you know, would you necessarily be afraid, especially in half the city that's just demolished or, you know, in tatters? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think, like you said, I think you could definitely have done this. And it didn't feel like to me that they were afraid of Batman being it didn't feel like a Luke Skywalker situation from the sequels where it's like, oh, we can't put him in there. It completely becomes this show. I do think there's you could even just had Bruce Wayne show up, you know, at some point. I think you could have done anything like that because I think these writers prove themselves to be good enough for that. I think they realized they didn't need it.
Let me challenge you. Where would you have put Bruce Wayne? I don't see a spot for Batman. Because I think that Batman becomes a distraction and too many questions afterward. But Bruce Wayne, I could be persuaded. Where do you see him? Where would he be?
Right. I think that the only time you could have put Bruce Wayne in there is that he could have been in that scene where Bella Real was in the when Oz is at the town hall. And he looks up and she's there. Could have had a scene where he's talking with her. And then that sense you get this
okay.
picture that Bruce Wayne has kind of moved out of his isolation status and into a place where it's like Batman is not the only solution for the city. Maybe we need Bruce Wayne too. I think that could have been a perfect place. And
that's
again,
fair.
It doesn't take away from anything there. It's just more like it gives you a real kind of character growth moment for that character without him having to say anything or even really be doing anything mm-hmm. other than just being there talking to the new mayor in light of everything that's going on. That's the only type of scene that I think that would have really worked. Again, these writers proved themselves to me that they could, I think, if they really wanted to, they could have inserted Batman. But I just think that they were smart enough to also realize this isn't his story and he's not needed here at this moment because this is about the ascendancy of Oz in a very quick time frame, which is going to lead in directly into whenever that next movie comes out. You know, they've said that. And so I think that this just does a great job of doing that, being very clear on what its story is without needing – you know, the character of Batman per se. And so I'm sure people are like, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth here, Matt. But, you know, again, I'm glad that they didn't go that direction. I love, though, that the end of the series really does, I think, give us this thought process with this massive upheaval in the underworld like this. There's no way Batman wouldn't hear about that and then would be interested.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would put it on his radar. And so, you know, I like that. So, we talked a little a bit, and you had mentioned a little bit about Vic, and, you know, we had this character played by Renzi Feliz, and I, like you, one, I thought his portrayal was fantastic, and I thought the arc for this character of basically being a forced slave, basically, to Oz, a forced servant to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he's cornered and he can't do anything else, to becoming somebody who feels like Oz is family and would die for him,
mm-hmm.
and then being betrayed was, I mean, it is great, man.
It is. And I think this is something where, wading into potentially controversial statement territory here, so bear with me, everybody, and understand everything I say, if I say it ineloquently, it's not with intent, okay? But the fact that they chose to have a character that had a speech impediment, a stutter, and not call attention to it, not make it a plot point, not make it something where you talk about it constantly, and not even have Oz pick on him for it, is, I think, an instruction manual sort of way to say how you can expand your characterizations and casting opportunities by not making it a cause celeb, if you will, to simply do it. And this is the character. And nobody bats an eyebrow. Nobody says anything about it. It's just the character. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
And it doesn't become something that mires the rest of the show. I will say additionally that with or without it, it's such a gentle and lovely portrayal of a kid who's in over his head and doesn't realize it, and doesn't realize he's being manipulated, which in such a way that it makes it even more horrific when you realize that, again, coming back to the main point, the show and Oz have been playing you this whole time into thinking, well, at least he can be kind to Vic. At least he can show some sort of humanity there. And you find out, not only does he lack that, but the betrayal that is portrayed when Vic is being choked, which is like the most personal way Penguin could have killed him.
Yeah.
It's not just a shot in the head. It's not painless. He knows Vic is aware of the whole thing happening while it happens.
Yep. Yeah.
It's just stunning. And I remember early on in the show, and it's played so well, when he decides not to go off with the girl when he could have. It's at that point where you just think to yourself, oh, Vic, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Like, and that's the moment where, as an audience member, the writing and the performance have won you over so much that it breaks your heart when he doesn't do it. Because you know at that point, you're like, ah, this does not end well for him. There's no way it could.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I loved about what you said there, too, was that his speech impediment became this thing that became an endearing quality for Oz, in the sense that, you know, he was always patient enough with him. There were some times when he would kind of yell at him to spit it out or whatever, but he never looked down on him because of that, right? He always treated him as somebody who had worth and value, which I think was great. And again, it becomes something to which, like you mentioned, there's always this feeling that Vic is semi-loved by Oz, or at least, you know, cared for by him. And a part of that is just the chemistry that these two actors had on screen together. This weird, you know, toxic father-son relationship that they've got going on. And it's just so well played. And so, yes, at that very... And the beauty of that is that Vic is the one person that if Oz turns on like this, he's irredeemable.
Mm-hmm.
And so they set the whole thing up, and then they create this irredeemable moment in the end where Victor is betrayed, where he's given everything to this guy, and yet it's not enough.
Nope.
Because, you know,
here's a question.
Oz realizes it's a weakness.
Here's a question. Yes.
Or he thinks it's a weakness.
Here's a question. Do you think, because of the way they play the scene, I want to go back and rewatch it again. Do you think if Vic never says to him, you're like family to me, I really feel like the way that moment's played is that's the moment where Oz is like, oh, okay, well, I got to kill you now. Do you think that if Vic doesn't say we're family, do you think that's the moment at which Oz says, okay, like basically Vic survives to the next beat in this story? Do you think that happens?
I think it's a possibility. I think you've kind of hit on something that's really interesting there, because of course the reason that he's killed is for that reason, that he's too close, or at least Oz thinks he's too close, and that makes him a liability, because, you know, especially it's weird too, because, you know, this whole thing has been about just his relationship with his mother and wanting her, you know, affection, and for her to think that he's just the greatest thing since individually wrapped slices of cheese. And that's just not it. And she's never going to give that to him because she knows exactly what he did and she hates him for it. And I think, you know, because he almost died because of her, and then her basically turning on him and his, you know, reality creation mind, he doesn't want that anymore. He doesn't want anybody else, basically, that he has to make pretend with. He just wants to live his existence without having to be beholden to anyone else other than himself. And I think, yeah, you're right. If maybe Vic doesn't say that, it's a different story for him.
And that winds up being interesting, I think, as well, because with the you'll forgive me that I've forgotten the character's name right now, but his main squeeze, the mall, the...
Oh, Eve?
Eve.
Yeah.
That last moment with her, where she's
just
dressed up like his mom when he was a kid, and she's talking to him that
creepy
way. It's unsettling. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's unsettling, and it's really wild, because that is family to Oz. And I think maybe mm-hmm. what it is when Vic says, you're like family to me, Oz sees him as competition for mom's affections. Because if you think back, mom was nice to Vic.
Yep.
Mom started treating Vic well. Mom started warming up to Vic. And that undoubtedly plays in with Oz as well, as soon as Vic says, you're like family to me, that means we're like brothers. My brothers fought for my mom's attention. I can't have that.
Yep.
I've done this before.
That's a good point.
Got to get rid of you.
Yep.
Which,
like,
is
not doing that again.
Creepy all over again. Just, just gutting what this show puts you through, but in a great way. In a great way.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes. Yes. No, I think you said that so well. You know, one of the beauties of this show is the character of Sophia. And Kristen Milioti playing her. I knew her, of course, as a character from How I Met Your Mother. If anybody hasn't seen the show, I won't spoil it for you and who she plays. But she's phenomenal. And I think the beauty of her that we didn't talk with Vic, but both of these are brand new introductions to the Batman lore.
Mm-hmm.
And both feel so incredibly perfect for this series and the show. And she is gangbusters awesome. Like every time that she was on screen, she knows exactly how to chew up the scenery without coming across as feeling forced or over the top in a way that doesn't fit with the operatic nature of this show. And I think that is incredible.
I agree. I think that she winds up, I think what's fascinating is she winds up being a scene stealer the same way that Penguin was a scene stealer with Batman. There were times where I was really invested in Sophia a whole lot. And I think that her arc, especially as that counterpoint, again, it gets back to the writing, but the way that the actress plays Sophia is, I did not watch How I Met Your Mother. I don't know if I've seen her in anything else. I probably have not. But she inhabited the character unquestionably. And I like the way you put it with this, you know, she can chew up the scene because there are definitely very dramatic moments, like when she murders the entire family and when she blows the guy's brains out completely nonchalantly. But then you see everything that she's witnessed and gone through and you say, oh, well, I can kind of understand why this person is the way that she is. And you also see the fact that she's always been struggling to try to get that humanity. Like she wants to be human again. She really doesn't want to be a monster. And it's sort of like, and then by the end of it, simply by being in the orbit of Oz, it's inevitable that she becomes one. And even it's this, even her obsession becomes really interesting because her obsession with Oz, she could have walked away. She could have won, but she just wanted Oz to admit what a POS he was. Because it seemed to me, maybe I'm off base here. Let me ask you. It seemed like Sophia's motivation was to prove to herself that she wasn't him. In a sense. Do you agree with that? One of her motivations, not all of her motivation, but one of her motivations was to prove to herself that she wasn't the Penguin.
No, I think that's very, I think in many ways that's really true. I think that what she wants is to be the character that everybody can look up to, that everybody can see as being the reasonable one. And in some ways, they both kind of want the same thing, which I think is really interesting, which is they want people to respect them, right? They want people to treat them as if they have worth and dignity and that they're worth loving and caring about, right? And for her, it's even worse because, you know, legitimately, she was turned on by her father. And it's kind of awful, right? Because, again, her father does very similar things to Oz, right? He wants to control the narrative around his life. And he wants people to see him in a certain way. And the last thing that he wants is for somebody to be able to kind of question who he is. Other than what he shows the world. And there's such an interesting thing about Sophia because she is struggling then to be somebody who's just trying to figure out who she actually is in light of all this, after all this, like, because she has no clue. And what she finds in the end is that even in trying to find herself, like you said, she's gotten sucked into being something she doesn't want to be. And it's the last thing she wanted to be a part of, which is pretty freaking interesting. And I really like the way that you tapped into that, because I find that to just be really interesting here about this character. And it's one of the things that I think, you know, makes it so interesting then to be able to sympathize with this character in a way that you can't ever sympathize with Oz,
mm-hmm.
which is really, really interesting.
I think that the entire arc is so complex and so interesting. And you mentioned new character created for this. That's another thing that other franchises often struggle with, is creating creating characters that feel authentic to the world that they're building.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gets back to, again, Sophia is authentic for this story. She's not created because she needs to be an update of a Batman character. She's not created because she needs to become a female Mr. Freeze. She's not created for any reason to fit her into a franchise. They put the health of the show first. And I think Sophia is case in point number one. This, in other hands, this could have very easily been Batman shows up a couple of times in the series. Penguin is a solo actor who's just rising up through the ranks. And instead, we get this very complex drama because they decide, no, we need characters playing against characters, and we need the right characters for this story to exist. And we'll worry about them, quote unquote, fitting mm-hmm. into the universe later.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think there's something really interesting. And I think this is the way in which you kind of insert a new character into a very old series, right? And, you know, of course, one of the most interesting parts about this, right, is that, you know, I don't know why I didn't think about this as the show was going on, but yes, she's Selina Kyle's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates an incredibly interesting dynamic then moving forward for the show, because of course, the relationship that Bruce had with Selina.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to happen there. You know, I think that's the wonderful way in which this show was able to find life in the Batman universe without just doing all the things that we've already seen before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that there's a real thread that they can pick up, because the thing where I would despair a little bit, quote unquote, but it all depends on what story you're telling. The trap they've laid for themselves is Sophia's such an interesting character. And I would have said this about Vic if he had survived. Sophia is such an interesting character, and I enjoyed her arc so much that my thought is, well, okay, are they doing a season two? And if not, she's going to be in the Batman too, right? Right? Because I want her in whatever the next thing is, because I enjoyed being with the character so much. I want her back. I don't want them to section this off completely now. And again, that's a thing that other franchises struggle with. They created a character here that's new that I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to get more of this character, right? Because I don't mm-hmm. want no more of this character. I want this character back.
Right.
And that's a, yes, that's a trap in and of itself.
100%. And, you know, I think another thing that was really interesting and goes right along with our discussion of Sophia was just the way in which they handled the Maroni family in general. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously having Salvatore Maroni played by Clancy Brown is phenomenal.
The magnificent Clancy Brown. The absolutely wonderful, can yes. do no wrong on screen or on voiceover work, Clancy Brown. of whom I have been a devoted fan ever since first encountering him as the Kurgan as a young lad watching Highlander on videotape, VHS specifically.
Yeah. He's amazing. And one of the smartest things and one of the most interesting things I think that they do with him is instead of him having the same type of presence that he has in every single, you know, show and being the exact same type of character, they twist it up a little bit. And, you know, they give him a wife who is Persian and then change the whole dynamic of his family from being this Italian-driven family to being a Persian-driven family. And it just creates a very interesting, wonderfully new, fun dynamic that you're not expecting. And I just think it's so well done. And it what it does in that is it gives life to this character, and it makes you feel like you don't know what to expect from this character because he has just enough differences to be like, I don't know exactly how this is going
to
go.
Yeah, I think that it adds a humanity to the character, a believability to the character, because people, you know, we all get locked in. It's like, oh, it's the Italian crime family. It's like, but, you know, this feels like a very, forgive me for putting it this way, but, you know, I mean, America is a nation of blended cultures and immigration and everything like that. This feels like something that would happen in the real world where the guy fell in love with the right ambitious woman and the rest of it didn't matter. And it gets
exactly
it actually mentally, and stay with me on this, it always gets back to a dramaturgical note that I read in a production of Guys and Dolls. I love Guys and Dolls. It's one of the greatest musicals ever created. And I saw it at an arena stage in Washington, D.C., and they did colorblind casting. And the dramaturgical note went in and said a lot of people would react, and I'm paraphrasing here, I can't remember, you know, this is like 20, 30 years ago. And it says, you know, a lot of people react to this type of casting. Oh, it's the 1950s mob. How on earth, you know, would you have, you know, all of this multiracial cast? And in the dramaturgical notes, it said, ultimately, in the criminal world, the only color they care about is green. They don't see differences so long as you're a producer. And it's like,
well, and in some ways, loyalty too, right?
Yeah, production and loyalty can overcome almost any obstacle. And now, obviously, historically, not all the time, sort of thing. We know the lore that's built up over time and all of that, but. You know, I think it's a nod to that sort of thinking of the only thing that really mattered to Maroney was, like you said, loyalty. He found a woman that would be loyal to him, that he could trust, that would help him run his family. Well, of course, he'd fall in love with that woman and it wouldn't matter where she was from.
Yep.
And that makes
more.
That makes him interesting.
Yes.
You know, he's not just a cookie cutter. He's not, okay, here's another Martin Scorsese type of character. Okay, we're good. You know, all right, hey, here's the mob guy. Instead, it's, you know, if anything, it even gives real fire to how angry he is about what Oz does. I mean, anybody would be. But, like, it adds that extra layer of, like, he truly found the perfect companion for him, and like that, that's a whole other dimension to it.
Yeah, no, I love that point. I think that you're right on target with that, and it's one of the things that really made me enjoy the characterization here, the thought process behind all of these characters. It really truly did feel like that they thought through.
Yeah, and let me
what they were doing with every single character, and what it. And this is the thing, what it enabled them to do to be able to change the character in a way that was interesting, but then would add something to the character that felt important as well. Like, it wasn't we were just changing things to change things. It also felt like, okay, well, what does this do for the character? Why would we do this? What would happen if we did this for the character? And then what would it mean for them, you know, in every way, in every single part of their life. And that's something that just this show felt really you know, and this is something we've talked about so many times on a lot of these shows, right? It's like you're just pumping out content to pump out content, and you're like, why am I watching this, right? And I never felt that about this show. And I think the Maroni character is a great example of me not feeling like that, because they had found a way to do something incredibly interesting with a character that I know from many other things, and at the same time make him feel new, unique, interesting, and fresh. And that's just wild, man.
And additionally, a whole thing while you were talking that I thought of that points to exactly what you're talking about. Oz comes from the background he comes from, where, you know, he murders his brothers, Oedipal thing going on. Sophia comes from a father who murdered his wife and murdered women and then framed her for it. And then when you get to Maroni, he's a crime boss, but he's actually a very dedicated family, you know, in his own way. He actually loves his family. And that, I think, creates a whole other odd dynamic about why Oz would be repulsed by him, I guess, like, because it's something Oz can never have.
Yep.
So anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to drag it out. Just wanted to, like, it was while you were talking and the way you said it, like, it sort of brought that into my brain too.
Dude, no, I think that's an excellent point. And again, I think that what it does is it speaks to the layers to which this show has, to the, as you begin to kind of pull them apart and you begin to think about each different layer, it makes it much more complex and much more interesting. And it makes it something to which you're actually interested in even watching again. I think that's the thing about this show is that I also found myself thinking, oh man, I kind of want to go back now and watch every episode again and know what's coming and then be able to pick up on all the little hints, the little pieces, all the things that they're doing that I didn't expect the first time, but I can get now. And I think that's the thing that I would be you know, really interested in being able to kind of go back and do. And so, John, gosh, it does feel like one of those things where I think there are so many different places where we could go through and really talk about very interesting parts of this show. We could go in so much more depth, right? And look, nobody needs that. Nobody's got hours to spend with us on that. So what I'm really interested in is this. It feels as though, and maybe I'm mistaken, but it feels as though we've had nothing but effusive praise for this show.
Yep.
And so that does make me wonder, where are you going to end up with the ratings?
On a scale of 5, it's a 5. It's one of the best shows I've seen in years. Hands down. No hesitation on that one. Giving it a solid 5. There isn't a thing I would change. It had me glued to the screen, kept surprising me, kept my interest the entire time. I'm not going to say I fell in love with the characters, except maybe Vic. But I enjoyed getting to know them in the sense that, like, I just enjoyed getting to know them because it felt worthwhile. So, solid 5. How about you?
You know, it's one of those things where I'm right there with you. You know, this is just the type of show that I think, you know, when it comes to what we're getting with all of the content we're getting, right? With all the content that we've got coming out, like, these are the type of shows that we want. Right. And I think what this ends up feeling like for me, and maybe you'll agree, this feels like quality over quantity.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't feel like something that they had to do. It felt like something that they really wanted to do and then thought through every single piece of it and made sure that this kind of fit every single aspect of you know where they're going in you know the this Batman whatever their universe thing that you know I don't even know what it is right but it just felt like this is a thing that fits within this universe so well and you know I'm at a place where it's like I don't need more of the Penguin show because now I'm ready. This is exactly what they wanted, right? I'm ready for that movie to come out. Whenever that's supposed to happen.
Oh, it's just another couple years. Don't worry about it. It's
just
fine.
Just another 5, 6, 20 years. And we'll get the Batman 2. By that point, Pattinson will be 85, and it'll feel like the Dial of Destiny. So anyway,
heyo.
I'm just teasing. John, if people did want to catch up with you, and you know, see what is going on with you, where else would they be able to find you and catch up with you?
Well, just look for me as Kessel Junkie out there in the wilds of the internet, and you can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network appearing on two shows. One of them is called House Lights, where we look at the work of directors. We have a lot of fun with that. We have our own twist on it. And, of course, I co-host, very proudly, a show that has its own esteemed pedigree, Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast over on the Nerd Party, and I co-host that with a one Mr. Matthew Rushing. Matt, that's you.
It is me. And of course, you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. You can also find me here all over the network with all kinds of Star Trek talk. So hopefully you'll check that out. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with an extra show there that's completed called Outpost, where we talked about every single Harry Potter chapter, one chapter at a time. Thank you so much for listening. And y'all come back now, you hear?